loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. In our first half hour, we take a look at the biggest stories so far this week, including the government shutdown and moves by possible 2020 presidential contenders. And then, because it's Wednesday, we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the government shutdown entered its 12th day today. Meanwhile, everything from the Environmental Protection Agency to the IRS to the National Parks and the Department of Homeland Security are closed. That didn't stop border guards from firing tear gas at would-be migrants, however. Next, the 2020 race for president is heating up for both parties. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren effectively announced over the weekend that she was running for president, the first of as many as two dozen Democrats thinking of making the leap. Meanwhile, Utah's new Republican Senator Mitt Romney harshly criticized President Trump in a New Year's Day op-ed in the Washington Post, and he's not the only Republican being talked about as a primary challenger to the president. Then, a new Congress is about to be sworn in, and Democrats will assume control of the House of Representatives, threatening to use their committee chairmanships to escalate the Mueller investigation and other investigations targeting the Trump administration. What does 2019 hold for Russiagate? And then, in a New Year's address, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that he was ready to meet again with President Trump at any time, and he reaffirmed his commitment to denuclearization. But Kim also warned that his country might have to pursue what he called a new way if the United States insisted on imposing new sanctions. President Trump, meanwhile, said that he welcomes another meeting. And finally, yesterday was a day Brazilian progressives had dreaded. It was Jair Bolsonaro's inauguration. Brazil's new president is very much in the mold of Donald Trump, but even more bombastic. He has said that he will, quote, rid Brazil of socialism, unquote, and would open vast portions of the Amazon rainforest to developers. President Trump tweeted to Bolsonaro, quote, the USA is with you, unquote. And in other headlines, almost 400 Kurdish fighters have left the Syrian city of Manbij in response to threats from neighboring Turkey, according to the Syrian Defense Ministry. The People's Protection Units, better known as the YPG, recently asked Syrian government forces for protection from Turkey. The YPG took the city of Manbij from the Islamic State in 2016. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo indicated that he would support former Vice President Joe Biden in the event that Biden runs in the 2020 Democratic primary for president. Cuomo said in an interview, quote, of all the names that are out there, I think Joe Biden has the best case, unquote. Biden has topped many early public opinion polls, although critics argue that this is simply by virtue of name recognition. The Spanish Coast Guard reported rescuing 325 migrants from the Mediterranean Sea in the first 2 days of the new year. Spain saw 56,000 migrants arrive by sea in 2018 from January 1st until December 19th, and reports show that another 769 died trying to do so in the same time frame. Spain is now taking in more migrants than any other European country, including Greece and Italy. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan had his first full day on the job today, replacing ousted Secretary James Mattis. Shanahan has reportedly stressed the importance of strict adherence to the newly adopted National Defense Strategy, which identified, quote, great power competition, unquote, against Russia and China as the key goals of U.S. foreign and military policy. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week so far and put them into perspective. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Jacqueline Lookman. Jackie is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Happy to be here.
We're going to go over a number of stories. We want to move quickly because there are a number of stories in this first half hour of Loud and Clear. But of course, perhaps the biggest story right now here in Washington, D.C., where so many people in this area work for the federal government and currently they are not working, is the government shutdown. Jackie, now we have the Democrats taking control of the House. They say that their priority is to open the government. What are they proposing? What will Trump do?
So apparently the proposal is the original proposal, the $1.5 or $6 billion for generic border security funding. The Democrats have not backed off of that. Trump is still, from what we can tell so far, still holding to his demand for $5 billion for the border wall. But if that stalemate continues, then government workers, federal workers across the country continue to be unemployed. And even as people seem not to care, especially Trump supporters, seem not to care that federal workers and their paychecks are being held hostage over this wall that's never going to happen, what we are seeing is the effects of federal agencies and federal services not being funded across the country.
800,000 federal workers affected, John.
800,000 federal workers. And, you know, Jackie was telling us before we went on the air that it's not just the federal workers, of course, it's the contractors as well. Now, if you're a federal worker, the likelihood is that you're going to get your back pay retroactively. So you're not going to lose anything. But if you're a contractor, you're out. You either have to use vacation time, or if you don't have vacation time, you can borrow against it up to 48 or up to 40 hours, or you just lose the money. Now, most federal workers, despite the fact that they're seen by so many Americans as Washington fat cats living on the high on the hog.
I talked to a family over the holidays. The woman in the family, the adult woman in the family, worked for the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
She lives paycheck to paycheck. So
exactly.
For the holidays, it was a big blow.
That was going to be my point. Most federal workers actually do live paycheck to paycheck.
And these are important services too, right? So, I mean, some of the things that are shut down are like the Department of Agriculture's loan program that helps small farmers, or, you know, the IRS, for instance, is shut down now. And this is the year that the tax cuts take effect. So, you know, it's like, it's logistically difficult. I mean, the tax cuts, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's just sort of, you know, people want, you know, like an effective like tax administration, in the sense that, you know, you're not going to have to wait like a million years for, you know, whatever assistance you need.
Yeah, I mean, and if you live in a city like we're here in Washington, D.C., so we've got the National Mall and all of these National Park Service facilities, you could already see the breakdown in federal services if you went on to the National Mall last week, where all of the trash cans were overflowing. There were rats all over the place because the National Park Service was not open. There was no staff to pick up the trash. And that's also being seen in the National Park Service facilities across the country. When in national parks, where you're seeing the same thing, overflowing trash, nobody's cleaning up the bathrooms. So that's a mess.
Yeah. Before we talk about the politics of this a little bit more, I do want to just mention that there's an article, say, in the New York Times today, shutdown leaves food, medicine, and pay in doubt in Indian country. And then this is from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. For one tribe of Chippewa Indians in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, the government shutdown comes with a price tag, about $100,000 every day of federal money that does not arrive to keep health clinics staffed, food pantry shelves full, and employees paid. Again, if you're not on a reservation, if you're not an affected person, if you're not one of the federal employees, if you're not a child of a federal employee, if you weren't planning to go to a park this week, you know, all of these people who are affected, if you're not one of them, you may not feel it, but it's starting to have a big impact.
It really is. And there are other things, too, that people aren't really thinking about. You know, we kind of chuckle and shrug our shoulders when we see that the zoo is going to be closed here in Washington, for example, or the Smithsonian institutions. But what about things like medical research?
Right.
What about research at the Department of Agriculture? What about programs that subsidize poor farmers? I mean, there's still a lot of dirt farmers in this country, especially in the South. Talk about living hand to mouth and week to week. Those people aren't being paid either. So we're rapidly getting to a point where lives may be on the line. This is day 12. We've entered day 12 of the shutdown. The longest shutdown in history was 21 days. There's no end in sight, despite the fact that the president and Democratic leaders are meeting today. This is, I think, at least so far, a case where an irresistible force is meeting an immovable object.
Yeah.
And so we have nothing to look forward to, not in the near term anyway.
Well, we'll see. I want to explore the possibilities of what a deal might look like. But before we do that, let's just again help the audience frame what this is all about. Donald Trump says this was necessary because without the wall, and Walter, he said it was a concrete wall, right? It wasn't just any kind of fence.
Beautiful concrete
wall. What happened there? I'm interrupting myself, but go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. So the big ask that Donald Trump has, the demand that Donald Trump is placing on the Democrats is that he won't sign any spending bill that doesn't include, he wants at least $5 billion for a quote-unquote the wall. It's a continuation of his anti-immigrant campaign, his, scapegoating campaign, but one that is now having this big radiating effect.
But Walter, there was a tweet where Donald Trump had said, when other people from the Republican Party says it doesn't have to be a concrete wall, it could be a fence.
It doesn't even have to be a wall. It's a metaphor for a wall.
But then what did Trump tweet?
Trump said that no, it will be made out of concrete. It'll be,
it must be concrete.
Yeah. So obviously it's just like a political stunt. It's just about, the optics. And by the way, Mexico was supposed to pay for everything.
Well, let's go back. Let's listen to Donald Trump. He said he had to do this. He had to shut the government down to fulfill a campaign promise. He insists that the Democrats have $5 billion of taxpayers' money for, I guess, a concrete wall, although he keeps, he hedges on that. Let's listen to what Donald Trump said when he was candidate Trump.
Oh, we're going to build a wall, all right. Who's going to pay for the wall? Mexico. They'll pay. You know why they'll pay? Again, these politicians are like sounding boards. Donald, what do you mean? These are people I run against. What do you mean by Mexico? They'll never pay for it. Of course they will. If I talk to them, I guarantee with them they'll never pay. Because they don't know how to talk.
Okay.
They don't know how to talk.
They don't
know. The politicians don't know how to talk to the Mexicans, but Donald Trump does.
He's a very stable genius.
But the reason trash is piling up a few blocks from here is not because the Mexican government isn't paying the wall, because guess what? They never were going to pay for the wall. It's because the Democrats haven't so far at least capitulated to Donald Trump. I mean, it's really something to remind people of how demagogic this whole issue really is, Jackie.
Yeah, I mean, there's this huge political theater that has been manufactured and has been made to look worse by the Border Patrol intentionally slowing down the processing of asylum applications for the people who have always been arriving at the border to make it look like there's this terrible, terrible crisis there. But there really isn't. At the same time, last year, I think, according to the latest numbers, 600,000 to 700,000 people overstayed their visas. And nobody's talking about those people. That's not a crisis. So this is all just political theater that is that hinges on this xenophobia, this anti-immigrant rhetoric, and it's very racist. And now it's spilled over into literally holding people's paychecks hostage.
Yeah, we're gonna leave this story and go on to other stories because there's other big issues in the news. But before we do that, again, for everyone, Donald Trump has met with the Democrats today, but he hadn't met with them since mid-December when this became a crisis. I want to hear Donald Trump talking about the potential of a government shutdown with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And then I want to wrap up this segment talking about the politics of what we expect, because this was, again, about politics. Let's listen to this meeting where Donald Trump is talking to Nancy Pelosi and Schumer.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay, absolutely.
And
we
I am disagree. Proud, and I'll
we
tell
disagree.
You what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck.
So, John, Trump took responsibility for the shutdown. I mean, perhaps he sort of walked into that trap. He saw a piece of dynamite on the floor and said, yeah, let me jump right on that thing.
That was the sign of an inexperienced politician. You could see the Democrats actually stifling smiles when he said that he would take responsibility for the shutdown. Chuck Schumer, especially, when the words were coming out of Donald Trump's mouth, Chuck Schumer couldn't believe his ears and had to stifle a smile because they've gone through these shutdowns in the past. The shutdowns are never popular. They're never popular with the American people when they're not getting their Social Security checks. They're not getting their welfare benefits or whatever it is. You can't go to the national park. You can't go to the zoo. You can't get somebody to answer your questions when you call the IRS. People get tired of this nonsense.
Okay, let's do a real fast before we end. How will this end? Will it end? Will there be a compromise? Of course, the Democrats in the past were willing to give Trump lots of money for a wall.
$20 billion last year, in exchange
for him agreeing to rescind the executive order on DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the Dreamers. 15 seconds, Jackie, your prediction?
The Democrats are going to give him $1.5 or $1.6 billion, and they actually have the political capital not to do a doggone thing else.
Okay, John Kiriakou?
Oh, I agree. I wouldn't be surprised if they give a little bit more, but I think they're going to get something big in return, like DACA.
Walter Smolarek, are you making predictions?
If I have to, I would say that they'll give him like $1.3 billion for border security like they originally offered, and then not get anything in return.
But does the shutdown continue then?
Probably for a few more days.
Okay. Jackie Lookman, let's go on to other issues. Virginia expands Medicaid under newly elected Governor Northrop. I mean, that might not be a big national news story for people around the country, but for low-income people in Virginia, a very big story.
Yeah, it's an enormous story because people don't understand the demographics of Virginia. People think of Richmond and, you know, Richmond is all cosmopolitan. Virginia is very rural. It's very agricultural based, and there are a lot of poor people in Virginia, especially even when you look at Richmond. Richmond also has a sizable low-income population. And this has been a fight that's been going on in Richmond for a long time. The only thing that changed the demographics, that changed the landscape for this to happen was Northrop winning. And because the Republicans still had nothing to replace the ACA, and the Republicans in the Virginia state legislature finally read the tea leaves and said, you know what? Our party isn't going to replace the ACA with anything.
They gave up.
And they really did just give up because they were forced to.
The Democratic leader now in the House of Delegates is a woman for the first time in Virginia's history. She's also an outstanding politician when it comes to policy. She saw this. She saw this happening and she said, now's the time to strike.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what she did. She went to the governor and said, we can get this thing passed. You're right, Jackie. The Republicans had no plan to offer to replace it, despite having 10 years to mm-hmm. come up with something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be the law.
The other big story is the Democrats are retaking control of the House of Representatives. They won 40 seats.
40 seats with one still undecided in North Carolina.
They needed 23 to retake the House. So now we have a, quote, divided government. Republicans control the Senate. The Democrats control the House. Trump, of course, is the president. For legislation to become law, it must be signed by both houses. It must be reconciled if there are differences between both houses. And then it must be signed into law by the president of the United States. That's how it works. So under these circumstances, does anything happen? What's the Democrats' strategy? Obviously, everyone is positioning themselves for 2020. Will the Democrats come towards Trump on any issue? What about infrastructure, for instance?
Yeah, I think the Democrats are going to remain staunchly centrist. They're not going to do anything that they consider risky. They're not going to push any kind of progressive anything right now unless they know they have a sure win with support from Trump. And there is so little as far as anything progressives actually want that are important that he would support. So I think the Democrats are going to, as far as legislation is concerned, stick to the center. They're going to play it safe and they're going to see who comes out on top for their top contender for 2020. Who one of those contenders is not going to be Elizabeth Warren. I'm just going to put that out there.
Okay. Well, let's diverge. Or digress. Okay. Elizabeth Warren this week announced that she was, in fact, throwing her hat in the ring. Again, a lot of other people are about to do the same thing. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker.
A lot. Politico is saying as many as 22 Democrats are considering running for president right now. Most of them apparently after having a conversation with their moms.
Including people who have like completely no chance. Like Bob Casey, right? Like so
exactly.
Bob Casey is like the most boring senator ever. He's from Pennsylvania. And he was just like, oh, I just have a duty to consider running for president. You know, I have a duty to the people of this country.
His point is that the Democratic Party is not conservative enough.
Oh, right. He's anti-abortion.
He's an anti-abortion candidate. He won by something like 12 percentage points more than Trump won by in Pennsylvania. So he's going to try to push the party farther
to
the right.
That's enough for him.
But how much of this, if you have 22 candidates, we know when the Republicans had that big field that never narrowed, which allowed somebody like Trump to win, because right. each of the candidates had some billionaire behind them. I'm not exactly each one, but a lot of them.
Pretty much. They all had these super PACs.
So even if your numbers were like 1% or 2%, you could keep going.
Newt Gingrich, right? Who had Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah, yeah. So they just could keep going and keep going. And that allowed somebody like Trump to actually gain a lot of traction, because even though he never had that many votes within the Republican primaries, it was more than the other candidates because it was dispersed, diffused between 18 people. How much of this is really people just making money? Like, they enter the Democratic or Republican primary, they get a billionaire behind them, or they start this fundraising campaign. They put their family on staff and their friends on staff, and then they got a gig for 2 years, and they're going to be on a few national TV debates, and their brand goes up. I mean, is it like that, Jackie Lookman? Is it really just, in many ways, just naked sort of capitalism playing it out as disguised as electoral politics?
I think for a lot of these candidates that are going to emerge from the Democratic Party, I think that's exactly what it is, because they a lot of the ones who are newer to presidential politics know that they have no chance. They know they have no chance. But this is the same party that's crowing about the stakes being so high and they must beat Trump. But there are all these people who are jockeying for that position knowing that they have no chance. So that they're not really trying to win to get Trump out of office. They're trying to build their own personal war chest in this. And I think that's another chink in the armor of the Democratic Party come 2020.
Let's go on. We have 5 minutes left. Bolsonaro, a Hitler admiring political figure, has become president of Brazil, Walter, and he says he wants to make Brazil pro-America and dispatch socialism in Brazil once and for all. We're going to do a segment about it later in our show. But anyway, that's big news.
Yeah, it's an extremely dangerous development. I mean, he's an outspoken supporter of the military dictatorship that ruled Brazil from 1964 to 1985. And he himself was actually a military officer during that time. He's filled his cabinet with former military leaders, generals. And it's, you know, clearly something that's meant to harken back to that period of military dictatorship. And so, you know, he's promising to target the left. You know, there's one particularly powerful social movement called the Landless Workers Movement. There's many, many other social movements, progressive political parties in Brazil that are bracing for repression. And, you know, it has huge international implications. You know, Venezuela is targeted for regime change. John Bolton gave his, you know, quote unquote, Troika of Tyranny speech targeting Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. And now Brazil with this extreme right wing, I mean, I think you can say fascist without exaggeration, president to be sort of this base for this sweeping, you know, rollback of all these progressive gains that had been won under, in Brazil, it was the Workers' Party government. And then there were similar governments throughout Latin America for the 2000s.
Another segment that we're going to cover later in the show is about Kim Jong-un's New Year address. These are annual events. Last year, it was very important event because on January 1, Kim Jong-un signaled that he was ready for a rapprochement, especially with South Korea. That's when everything got going. He said this time, Jackie, look, we're ready to go forward. We want to meet with Trump. We want to go forward with the Singapore summit declaration from June 12th. But guess what? If you expect us to completely disarm our country while you maintain ever profound, deepening, intensifying economic sanctions, you can forget about it. At the same time, while many critics said this shows that the peace with Korea and North Korea is impossible, Trump is keeping hope alive because he wants this to go forward.
Yeah, even after Kim Jong-un said late last year, backing off the assumption that they would denuclearize, Kim Jong-un said, no, as long as the United States continues to not only amass and grow its nuclear arsenal, we're not giving up. Don't expect us to either. But we will pursue peace with South Korea. That's a good thing. And it is still a good. And it's good that he's willing to meet with Trump. But I'm not willing to give Trump credit for this, because this has been a rapprochement, a peace between the Koreas that's been in the works for decades. And I think it's something that Kim Jong-un has wanted, because he's seen how his own country has suffered from that. I think Trump was just an opportunist in this, kind of saying that he's going to get North Korea to denuclearize and making promises that he couldn't deliver on. But that doesn't even matter, because there will be peace between the Koreas. And that's the point.
John Kiriakou, I think Jackie's right. It doesn't really matter what Trump's motives are.
No.
The fact that the possibility that peace could break out in Korea so many years after war broke out, and it was war after war, because World War II and before World War II was the Japanese colonial domination of that peninsula. Since 1950, the countries are technically at war. 1 minute left. It seems to me that this is a primary sort of fork in the road. Will there be peace in Korea? And if not, does it take the world and, of course, the people in Korea and the people in the region to an even more dangerous position? 1 minute left.
Well, to tell you the truth, I think that there will be peace in Korea so long as Donald Trump is president. I can't believe I'm even speaking those words, but the Democrats have proven that they don't like the way that this is going. They don't like the path that the president has taken on North Korea. And it's Donald Trump's pragmatism on this issue that has gotten us to the position that we find ourselves in. So I'm going to use that word pragmatism again, Brian. This is an argument really for all of us to be pragmatic on these issues. Jackie mentioned infrastructure earlier. Maybe it was you, Brian, that mentioned infrastructure. We should have the best infrastructure in the world. We're the richest country in the world. We should have the best roads, the best highways, the best hospitals and airports, et cetera. We don't, because we spend our money on war. Well, if Donald Trump wants to spend $7 billion or whatever it was, $1 trillion, I don't recall, on infrastructure, by God, that's the right thing to do. We should do it. And so the same thing with North Korea. If Donald Trump wants peace with North Korea, peace is a good thing. We should have peace with North Korea.
We're going to leave it right there. We were joined in studio by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined from Kalamazoo, Michigan, by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear, and we're joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Nicole Russell. Nicole, Kevin, welcome back.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Wow, Kevin. 2019, big year for people who are fighting to stop nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Again, we had the new year open with a tweet from, I think it was from the Strategic Air Command. It was a tweet picturing or showing a short video with a B-2 bomber. And Nicole, what did the tweet say?
Times Square tradition rings in the new year by dropping the ball. If ever needed, we are ready to drop something much, much bigger.
And then there's a video with big explosions.
Yep, there's a video with big explosions, clearly nuclear explosions, which obviously rated quite a bit of pushback on such an offensive and really violent tweet.
Kevin Camps, can you imagine any other country's military putting out a tweet on New Year's Eve that says hashtag Times Square tradition rings in the new year by dropping a big ball? If ever needed, we are hashtag ready to drop something much, much bigger. And then watch the at Air Force Global Strike. And it's a picture of a B-2 stealth bomber, big word, lethal over the meme. And then a video celebrating the explosion of nuclear weapons. I mean, it's madness.
Yeah, the U.S. government and military might not take it too well. And, another thing that occurred to me about that was that they were comparing essentially big bombs or even nuclear weapons with the big ball in New York City. And it was in the context of New Year's Eve, which is probably one of the biggest security risk nights of the year in New York City, which is the biggest security risk in the country. It was just wrong on so many levels. And if you look back over the decades during the Cold War, for example, New York City, of course, is going to be a top target in a nuclear war, as is Washington, D.C., but a lot of the comparisons to show what would happen if there were a nuclear war often look at Manhattan and what the damage would be. So it was just so wrong on so many levels. And, you know, they've apologized, they retracted it pretty quickly, but, you know, what kind of accountability is there going to be? If there's no accountability for whoever made that decision, then, you know, maybe it'll happen again.
Kevin, over the weekend, I was watching one of these decade in review, two decades in review, three decades in review kind of programs, and they talked about a film that made a real societal impact, made for TV film in the 1980s called The Day After. And it was about a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union from the perspective of a group of people living in Lawrence, Kansas. Very, very important film. They said that more than 100 million Americans watched it on TV. There were watch parties and family sat and watched it together. And there was debate for many weeks afterwards. One of the points at the time was first that a nuclear war was not winnable, which, of course, it isn't in any real sense of the word win. The other was that there's nowhere safe once a nuclear war is initiated. Here we are all these years later, Kevin, and people on Capitol Hill, Republicans on Capitol Hill, are beginning to say that a nuclear war is winnable. And in the event that there is a nuclear war, there are safe places to go in the United States, right? Everybody would flock to northern Idaho, for example, or move to North Dakota or Montana. That's ridiculous, right? Can you explain this to us? First of all, is a nuclear war winnable in any sense of the word win? And is there anywhere safe?
Yeah, I was one of the people who watched that show with my mom. I think I was either in junior high or freshman year of high school. Made a big impression on me, for sure. And look what I do with myself these days. So, well, you know, you guys have had speakers on your show, like the author of The Doomsday Machine, Dan Ellsberg, who pointed out that, you know, back in the 50s, because he started work during the Eisenhower administration in 59, I think it was, they realized back then that if there was an all-out nuclear war, that 600 million people would die worldwide. And the hydrogen bombs have just gotten bigger since then, and there are bigger cities for them to hit anymore. So those casualties undoubtedly would go up. And we also know from reports like the nuclear famine that if there were to be even 100 Nagasaki-sized bombs exchanged between India and Pakistan, for example, that was the case study, and it is one of the biggest risks in the world of a nuclear war right there, that just 100 Nagasaki-sized bombs would plunge the planet Earth into a nuclear winter, and up to 2 billion people would die from famine. So no, there's really nowhere to escape to. And, you know, what the tweet kind of reminded me of is the North Korean regime is rightfully criticized for its very provocative statements. This is further back in time now, but this kind of lowers the United States to that kind of level.
We have the issue of winnable nuclear war. Again, the tweet from the Strategic Air Command. The Strategic Air Command sent the same bomber, by the way. I think it's the B-2 bomber. They sent it all the way from Nebraska to overfly Korea.
That's right.
Or to fly right next to Korea about 3 years ago during the Obama years. They were making a point after North Korea had made a statement and sent up a satellite or something like that. They sent two of these planes all the way from Nebraska and back, showing that they had this long-range capability to go all the way there, not have to stop, not to be refueled, drop their payload of nuclear bombs on North Korea, and fly back. When you put out a tweet like this, it says to people like the North Koreans, look, not only do we make jokes about nuclear war, but we actually do believe in our heart that nuclear war is not only feasible, it's winnable, because you don't talk about we're ready to do this thing, even as a joke, without the implicit sort of foundational understanding like, yeah, we might not do it, this might be a joke, but we can do it. And we can do it because we can get away with it, meaning we can win a nuclear war. That there is a foundational logic. And then people like the people in North Korea or the people anywhere in the world who might be targeted by the U.S. government at some point will think, like, what are we going to do to stop these madmen? We have to have nuclear weapons.
Right.
Like, they don't understand anything else.
There was a really powerful scene in The Day After where survivors in Lawrence, Kansas were going through the rubble looking for things to survive on, and they found a radio, and it happened to just barely work, and they caught a very staticky transmission from somewhere, and it was a U.S. government proclamation that we had won the war, you know? And it was just really ironic, because they're in a dead city, you know? No, we won the war, so.
The Hudson Institute still exists here in Washington as a think tank. Herman Kahn was the founder of the Hudson Institute. I'm going to read a couple sentences to you about Herman Kahn. Of course, being my age, I knew all about Herman Kahn growing up because he was the advocate for winning a nuclear war. Yes, he was. And his Kahn's theory rested on two premises, one obvious, one highly controversial. First, nuclear war was obviously feasible since the United States and the Soviet Union currently had massive nuclear arsenals aimed at each other. And secondly, like any other war, it was winnable. Kahn argued that whether hundreds of millions of people died or merely a few cities were destroyed, he argued that life would go on as it had, for instance, after the Black Death in Europe during the 14th century or in Japan after the limited nuclear strike in 1945, contrary to the conventional prevailing doomsday scenarios of mutually assured destruction. Now, Herman Kahn was with the RAND Corporation. He was a military strategist. The Hudson Institute received lots of money from right-wing forces.
He was a mentor to Pat Buchanan.
Yeah. So this is not like some other world position.
No, this
like,
was a mainstream guy.
Even if hundreds of millions of people die, it doesn't mean we can't win. We can win.
So that's, I feel like, what I don't get here. It's like he and I are in different planets or different worlds. Even if that's true, which I think we know that is not true, that it would not only, quote unquote, only be two cities destroyed or whatever. It would, you know, far, far, far more people would die. I think we know that for sure now. Maybe we knew it back then. Either way, how is two cities or more being completely eradicated? How is that okay? How is that an okay option?
Because you win.
But like, what if your parents are in that city? What if your kids are in that? Like, I mean, that's not.
He's looking at it from a purely military point of view. You take the atomic bomb in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Now, Nagasaki and Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong. Nagasaki and Hiroshima weren't already destroyed by the America's firebombing campaign because the U.S. wanted to have some pristine, clean environments to be able to test as an experiment what the nuclear weapon would do to the populations. But every other city in Japan had already been destroyed by non-nuclear means. And so it showed in terms of military calculations, the U.S. government and if it was on the other side, it would have been the Japanese government or the German government were prepared to basically carry out genocide in order to win. So from a military point of view, genocide, and that's what we're talking about, makes sense.
And we've talked about that myth in the past, too. There's a great book by Gar Alperowitz called The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb. And what floored me was he documented very well that the war was over in Japan. You had the head of the U.S. Navy, Leahy. You had Eisenhower, who were very critical of the atomic bombing of Japan because the U.S. Navy had Japan encircled. There was not food getting in. There was nothing getting in. There was nothing getting out. The Japanese Navy was all but done. The Japanese Air Force didn't exist. It was a matter of time, and the Japanese government was trying to extend peace feelers in Switzerland, in different places in Russia, and the U.S. government wouldn't have it. And so it was really, you know, we had these two weapons that needed to be used to justify the expenditure of the money, and a people of color were targeted, and the rest is history.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I think that we had a year and a half ago Donald Trump threatening to, quote, totally annihilate North Korea. He said that from the General Assembly podium. That was awful. North Korea played it, I think, very cleverly and smart and actually in a straightforward way. They said in the beginning of last year when Kim Jong-un made his New Year address that they were ready for a rapprochement with South Korea and they were interested, willing to engage the United States in discussions about possible denuclearization. They also have declared a moratorium, a unilateral moratorium on nuclear weapons tests and intercontinental ballistic missile tests. We're going to have another segment in this show where we're going to talk in length and in depth about Kim Jong-un's address and Trump's response to it and the response from other parts of the media. This is a big issue, everybody. What happens on the Korean Peninsula? We see this issue as sort of the fork in the road in terms of issues of war and peace. Not the only one, but certainly a critical one. But given the fact that we have only about 16 minutes left in this segment and we have many, many other issues, let's go on to another story.
It's 2019. It's a new year. Kevin, let's talk about the renewables renaissance. It's a new year. It's time for new power sources. I know there are a lot of renewables that are getting more and more popular and getting geared up, including offshore wind. And I know onshore wind also has some really great possibilities, too. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, we have a whole section of our website called the Renewable Renaissance because there's just so much good news. So we try to post it there. So yeah, you mentioned offshore wind. That has tremendous growth potential and is starting to happen, especially on the Atlantic seaboard in the northeast of the country. So they are well underway with various projects like Cape Wind in Massachusetts. There's another one that's even further along off the coast of Rhode Island. New York State is getting it. Maryland, under Republican Governor Hogan, is getting it. So we're talking, in terms of offshore wind, the potential for nuclear scale, only it's not nuclear, it's actual clean energy. We're talking thousands of megawatts electric of potential wind power. And I remember it's been almost a decade ago, but Google offered to put like $5 billion into offshore wind on the eastern seaboard in terms of the transmission, because that was going to be a challenge. If every single turbine had to transmit the electricity to shore individually, that would boost the price considerably. But if there were a transmission backbone that paralleled the shore and brought it all in, you know, less lineage, that would save a lot of money. And Google was indicating it was interested to take part in that. So we're really on the cusp of tremendous growth in that area. And then I was just in Iowa back in October on a speaking tour about radioactive waste transportation. And I was so impressed by the size of the turbines that were going into the cornfields off of the interstate. I mean, I hadn't seen onshore land-based wind turbines of that scale before with my own eyes. And it's just very hopeful. There are a dozen states on the Great Plains that each one could provide 20% of the electricity supply of the entire country. So right there, if you had the transmission or the storage, you could electrify the entire United States with that wind on the Great Plains. And the good news is that some of these windy places, like Lake Erie, for example, you've got Cleveland right there. You've got Toledo. You've got Detroit. So some of these very windy places are very near where the electricity would be used anyway. And so that transmission challenge gets met because there's very little transmission required. And the same would be true of Iowa and Chicago and other big cities, for example.
So we know that we have a deadline, right? We know that the climate crisis is getting worse and worse. We know that coastal communities have been feeling this for decades already. But we also know that there's enough wind power just here in our nation, just here in a dozen Great Plains states, to supply all the electricity we need in the country. The policy choice needs to be made to figure out to get those transmission lines up and running, to get the storage, technology figured out, to get all of that moving and up and in place. And that hasn't happened yet. Is that right?
Yeah. And one of the stumbling blocks, we just saw in recent days in Connecticut, where nuclear power, old, dangerously old atomic reactors at the Millstone Nuclear Power Plant, were right at the trough next to solar and wind, getting these clean energy funds to try to mitigate the climate catastrophe. So what it is really it's a stealing of the money away from genuinely clean, safe, secure, affordable energy, solar and wind, and giving it to old nukes that have been subsidized over and over and over again for decades. And as these reactors get older, like Millstone, the dangers increase. So we saw it in New York with the $7.6 billion subsidy that went to old nukes on Lake Ontario. We've seen it in Illinois, $2.35 billion for three nukes that should have shut down for safety's sake. And unfortunately, states keep making this mistake over and over again, stealing from clean energy, giving it to nuclear.
And, you know, nuclear is billed, and we've talked about this on the show before, but I just think it's so important. And one of the biggest questions I had when we started talking with you every week, Kevin Camps, nuclear is billed as a clean energy, but we know that You know, there are myriad problems with nuclear, including, you know, really specifically a lot of the radioactive waste. So we're going from, you know, dealing with a climate crisis to dealing with polluting our communities with radioactive waste, with transporting radioactive waste. So, you know, anywhere that that waste goes is potentially incredibly dangerous for the communities around it.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a blind spot. So the only pollutant that we care about is carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases, which is a very important issue, of course, not to be downplayed. But as you mentioned, nuclear power produces a lot of poisons. So, you know, a couple hundred radioactive isotopes. There are routine radiation releases into the environment just on a good day at a nuclear power plant. They're not designed to keep it all in. It goes into the air, goes into the water, falls out downwind, downstream. And then, like you said, there's the radioactive waste of all categories, and high-level radioactive waste is the worst. So, you know, to call nuclear power clean is Orwellian, and there have even been attempts to define it in the past as renewable. They've never gotten away with it, but they might as well have, given these subsidies being stolen from clean energy initiatives and given over to not new nukes, but old nukes, which is really incredible.
And I know you've mentioned Florida and Arizona as two places that could really be harvesting wind and solar. What's been going on in those states in terms of the nuclear and coal industry versus renewables?
Yeah, Arizona is pretty amazing. When you look at these charts that show where the solar potential is in the country, you know, and there's different colors for better intensity, Arizona is off the charts. It's like very dark on these charts because the solar potential is so great. And the good news is there are arrays of solar panels and even a solar thermal concentration going in, which is very large scale. Again, it's in the hundreds or even thousands of megawatts potential. So these are as big as the biggest nuclear reactors or coal burners, only they are clean. They are solar. And another example is at the Moapa Indian Reservation outside of Las Vegas, which is a major solar panel arrays, a couple million solar panels. My colleague Ian Zabardi of the Western Shoshone Indian Nation, as the environmental director at the Moapa Reservation at the time, had a big hand in the installation of those panels. And it's happening all over, not just the Southwest, but other parts of the country. So it's great news. The bad news is that the coal burners and the atom splitters of this country, including utilities in Arizona, especially including utilities in Florida, they like their dirty, dangerous, and expensive technologies. That's how they've made their money in the past, off the public mostly. And so they continue to try to sabotage solar and wind and efficiency because they see it as competition. So that fight goes on. It's ironic that Arizona has the biggest nuclear power plant in the country. It's called Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant. It's west of Phoenix. And incredibly, there's not enough water for cooling purposes at Palo Verde. So what do? They pump the treated sewage water from Phoenix out to Palo Verde and use it for cooling water. So doing that, that 35-mile pump job, uses a lot of electricity. So it diminishes the net value of the nuclear plant in the first place. But it's also entirely unneeded, as are the nuclear plants in Florida. They could easily be replaced by solar.
It's also, I mean, I'm not sure. It's possible that they figured out the sanitation complications of pumping sewage water for 35 miles, but it seems like an unnecessary thing to have to do, honestly.
Yeah, it's so wasteful on so many levels. And to build a nuclear power plant in the desert like that in the first place, something that uses ungodly amounts of water, you have to wonder, what were they thinking?
I want to raise something about what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, tells us about radiation and why we should be concerned about it. I want to read from an answer that they provide in a frequently asked questions, a part of their website, Kevin. Here it is. Why do we need to be careful around radiation? Answer, this is from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. For the same reason we need to be careful about open flame, toxic chemicals, or knives. Used and stored properly, for example, a knife can help us prepare and eat food. Misused, it can cause injury and possibly death. Interesting approach to the issue of informing the public about the dangers of radiation, Kevin.
Yeah, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has never been worse under its current directorship. You've got a former Exelon nuclear lobbyist who was just added by Trump. You've got the former president of the Public Service Commission in South Carolina that wasted many billions of dollars of ratepayer money on two new reactors that were later canceled, and others who are already on there who are bad. And so it's reflected. I mean, I've been preparing for our January 23rd hearings in Albuquerque, New Mexico, about the centralized interim storage facility for high-level waste that Holtec wants to build in New Mexico. And something that shocked Barbara Boxer when she was chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee in the U.S. Senate several years ago was that in these licensing proceedings, the NRC staff, which is an active participant in the licensing proceedings, they are on the side of the company, on the side of the applicant. And many times they are to the right of the applicant. They are more rabid in their support for the proposal. And reading these legal filings as we prepare just reflects that. The NRC is beyond captured. They are advocates for the nuclear power industry. And your definition you just read there from the NRC website shows how active they are in the cover-up and the downplaying of the dangers of radioactivity.
Yeah, they're just like knives mishandled. There's another part of the frequently asked questions part, which is pretty amazing. What kind and how much radiation is produced by a nuclear power plant? Answer: an operating nuclear power plant produces very small amounts of radioactive gases and liquids, as well as small amounts of direct radiation. If you lived within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant, you would receive an average radiation dose of 0.01 millirem per year. To put this in perspective, the average person in the United States receives an exposure of 300 millirem per year from natural background sources of radiation. So actually, it's much more dangerous to be alive anywhere, no matter where you are, than it is to live within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant. Interesting thinking. Interesting presentation, Kevin.
Hey, I heard this phrase, spinning the splitting of the atom. And there's a lot of shenanigans that go into a statement like you just read from the NRC website. Those are all averages. And, you know, woe be to the person who actually inhales the radioactive gases that were intentionally released. Woe be to the person who accidentally ingests the radioactive water that was intentionally released. And what they seem to have left out of at least that particular statement is the high-level radioactive waste, the worst concentration of these poisons, as Nicole mentioned, that we have no solution for. We're just sitting on that problem as it grows into mountainous proportions beneath us. So, yeah, that's the agency that is charged with the protection of the public safety, health, and environment. And that's why we are in such hot water with this subject matter.
Well, speaking of trying to figure out storage for this, and since it's a new year and here in 2019, what are you, do you have any projections for how things are going to change this year? Do you think Yucca will actually get passed, or do you think we'll be able to keep preventing the dumping of radioactive waste into Yucca Mountain?
Yeah, good question. I mean, there's the meeting happening at the White House, Trump and congressional leadership of both parties, about this little government shutdown we're going through right now and the budget for the coming year. And Yucca dump proponents like Shimkus from Illinois and Upton from Michigan and others are trying to get a rider attached to whatever gets approved to fund the government that would fund the Yucca Mountain licensing proceeding at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to the tune of at least $60 million, or maybe they'll try to get away with more. So the state of Nevada, the Nevada congressional delegation who don't want the dump, and then the grassroots environmental movement are doing all we can to try to prevent that from happening. And we've been through this little dance for over 30 years at this point, and we've held it off, but it's always a fight. And so here we go again.
Interesting. Well, thank you for that analysis. And then I know in our last 2 minutes, I know you are a part of some of the legal proceedings that you were mentioning with Holtec and the interim storage facility. So what is the hearing in January and what can we expect?
This is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, which is a slow motion rubber stamp. We know what we're getting into. What we did just do beyond nuclear just a few days ago is our attorney, Diane Curran in Washington, D.C., and also Mindy Goldstein and Carolyn Reiser down in Atlanta at Emory University, Turner Environmental Law Clinic, filed court papers in federal court to get our foot in the door at federal court. And what we're doing is we're going to exhaust all our administrative remedies at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then as soon as they rule against us, we are off to federal court. And Beyond Nuclear has a single argument. These proceedings in Texas and New Mexico are illegal. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act does not authorize the Department of Energy to take title and liability for these high-level radioactive wastes at a private centralized interim storage facility. It's just as simple as that. It's against the law. So we hope that we'll have a more fair shake in federal court than we're going to get at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then our allies, a coalition of environmental groups, have 1,000,001 complaints about the Holtec dump that they are pursuing, from the transportation dangers to the geological, hydrological unsuitability of the sites targeted to the environmental injustice of it all.
That's the voice of Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to his website, beyondnuclear.org, to learn more about what they're doing. You can read his writings there. Most importantly, you can get involved with and show support for this important organization. We were also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.